I'm Rachel Bovard.
I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Emily Drashinsky.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. So welcome back, everybody. We have a lot to talk about today, a lot focusing on what's happening in the news and elsewhere. We're going to start with Josh, who's going to give us a rundown from a dispatch, actually, from the Federalist Society's annual convention and some of the tensions, I think, that are exposing themselves around originalism and forthcoming cases of the Supreme Court. Ben's going to talk about national conservatives more broadly, some takeaways from NatCon 2. Emily's going to give us the latest on the Rittenhouse trial and what we should take away from that. And then I'm going to talk about everybody's favorite subject, Steve Bannon, being held in contempt of Congress. So with that, I will take it off to Josh.
Yeah, what a fun show. So, okay, so let's kick it off with some of the more drier stuff, I guess, before getting to Rittenhouse and Bannon, a little more sexy topics. Okay, so yeah, so I was in D.C. last week. I briefly saw Rachel, so hello again, Rachel. I was in town for the Federal Society's National Lawyers Convention. I probably honestly wouldn't go to these at this point were it not for the fact that I was speaking on a panel and did my best to red pill the audience on a critical race theory panel, gave all my, you know, Chris Rufo talking points. It was a whole lot of fun here. But what I really want to talk about is because we've done this a lot. I've probably done a lot of segments here on like the conservative legal movement and the Dobbs abortion case and all this stuff, because this is kind of like my professional wheelhouse and my bread and butter. But I want to focus specifically on kind of like what I observe and what some of like fellow conservative bloggers, including on the Vol conspiracy, which is probably the most widely read legal blog out there, have started to observe as well, which is this real palpable tension and this kind of disconnect between kind of young conservative students, young conservative lawyers, even multiple judges who like oftentimes would like privately kind of come over to me and confide in me, and what we might call originalism Inc. or conservative legal movement Inc., kind of like the vetters, the gatekeepers, if you will, the people who run these various organizations who, you know, exist to kind of connect students with judges for clerkships and professional networking and things of that nature. And basically, just to kind of set the stage here, the National Lawyers Convention, which is the Federal Society's kind of marquee event, it's at the Mayflower every year in D.C. The Mayflower is kind of like a quintessentially kind of, you know, Farragut Square, DuPont Circle. It's a very swampy kind of hotel. It's very nice. I mean, like my room was perfectly nice. I'm not bashing the hotel, to be clear, but it's kind of, you feel kind of swampy when you're in there. And the halls of the Mayflower over the years during these conventions have been known to host more important conversations than the actual panels themselves. I've heard Professor Randy Barnett of Georgetown and Josh Blackman of South Texas College of Law, both of whom are friends of mine. It was kind of in the halls where they launched the lawsuit that ultimately became the first Obamacare lawsuit, the NFIB versus Sebelius. There's like a million kind of like anecdotal stories like that, right? So I didn't personally attend many panels, to be honest with you. I kind of just spent my somewhat limited time there in the halls. And it was, I'll start with this point. It did not go unnoticed that there was not a single panel at this convention on abortion, on the Dobbs case, even on Texas, on kind of the current litigation, you know, SB8, the somewhat infamous Texas abortion law. There was really no programming dedicated to this whatsoever. And that was noticed. A lot of people kind of said, like, well, what's going on here? Like, we have this Dobbs case in Mississippi on the table. It's our best chance to overturn Roe versus Wade since Planned Parenthood versus Casey 30 years ago. We probably should be talking about this, right? And it kind of gets to a broader point that I've talked about and written about at length, Rachel has written about at length here, which is this growing disconnect between young students and young lawyers who are just sick and tired of kind of the fetishization of administrative state and kind of neoliberal kind of economic issues, largely centered around kind of like George Mason Law School, which is like a famously libertarian law school. And there's not enough programming, not enough content dedicated to kind of the bread and butter cultural civilizational issues. I actually alluded to this myself in my address at NatCon. I had a whole paragraph about how this is the case, and I talked a little bit about Roe versus Wade and all of that there. But we really seem to be at a bit of a boiling point here. Josh Blackman, who I mentioned earlier, who's a buddy of mine, he had a blog post at Vol Conspiracy, which is the less histrionic wing of the Reason.com website, I guess we might say. And he basically said that what he said, that there is a divide between kind of the legal conservative movement youngsters and originalism Inc. And this divide is It's what I just said. It's like it's what we're trying to focus on here. It's the young crowd recognizes that we've had decades and decades of failures, that we have not accomplished the goals that motivated this movement when it first started in 1982. And numerous judges came up to me and basically said, like, this is it. Like, if we're not overturning like Roe versus Wade, or at least overturning Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the successor to Roe this term, it's all up in the air. I mean, I literally had judges come up to me and say, like, have you thought about trying to like start like a rival federal society? I mean, like, it's like at that level here. So we really are at like a real boiling point here. And I just thought kind of the palpable tension that I felt and that I know a lot of other people who were there felt was kind of just worth shining yet another spotlight upon. Personally, I like dance like a very delicate dance with the Federal Society because I'm a member. I speak there a lot, but I'm a critical member from within the broader fold, obviously. And I have friends on the inside who I try to work with to get good programming. But the upshot here, and I guess I'm happy to kick it open to the group on this note, is FedSoc to an extent is kind of just like a proxy. It's kind of just a proxy for kind of this professional conservative class. FedSoc obviously is kind of the legal version of the professional conservative class. And we just see this tension in not just the legal world, but in all sorts of worlds between kind of the young up and coming generation and the professional gatekeeping conservative establishment. So I know that the Dobbs case goes the wrong way. It's all up in the air in this particular area, but I wonder if it's really increasingly all up in the air in other areas as well. So, I mean, Rachel, let's kind of just kick it over to you to start us off here. I mean, you know, your Federalist essay was much discussed. So I'm curious if you have any other thoughts.
Yeah, it was weird. No one invited me to the Federal Society annual event. I'm not sure why. but I think you've laid it out very well. You know, we have this forthcoming Dobbs case, which presents the clearest question we've had in generations on the issue of abortion to the court. And it's a very clear decision for them. Is this conservative majority court capable and willing to strike down bad law, unconstitutional decisions, or are they not? And I think it's not too strong a statement to say, however they decide this case will determine the future path of the conservative legal movement. Because again, as you point out, so much of the conservative legal movement had its genesis in striking down, you know, Roe and a host of bad decisions. Now, I suspect that a lot of Federal Society members will hide from that. They will try to say, no, that's not about it. It was just judicial activism, you know, whatever, whatever. But no, a lot of this energy in Genesis was about Roe. And if we are producing judges that are unable to strike down unconstitutional law, then what are we doing here? And I think that's the fundamental question. But what's fascinating to me about this entire sort of just watching the battle lines, you know, for lack of a better term, be drawn on this issue, because you do have, you know, National Review on one side, who I think has actually been very laudable on this question, put out an entire issue saying we need to strike down Roe. There is no, you know, the question is literally binary. There's no middle way here. And on the other hand, you have the Wall Street Journal, which 3 years ago editorialized that no Trump judge should strike down Roe because that would be, you know, damaging the reputation of the court. And that represents, that Wall Street Journal position represents, I think, a clear positioning of the Federal Society over the past few years. And you can imagine, you know, you're speaking of the fact there were no panels on Dobbs at this conference. Can you imagine if Chevron were on the docket, right? If that was what was coming up and about to be struck down. And obviously for those who aren't familiar with it, Chevron is sort of the case of a case that deals with administrative law, right? It's the deference we yield to the bureaucrats. Not to say that that's not an important issue, but this is a motivating issue for the base. And I really do think there's a lot of self-reflection that's about to go on in the movement. And I think that's for the better. Honestly, this is the decision point that we've all been waiting for.
I'll just jump in quickly. I don't have a ton to add on the conservative legal movement itself, but I do think I remember when the Texas law was enacted. I think I said on Rising, there are a lot of, I guarantee you, sort of explaining this to the left, I was like, I guarantee you there are a lot of people over at the RNC who are very uncomfortable with this right now and who are not like the toothless rubes you think they are, just cheering to take over women's bodies. I think there's a discomfort in a lot of the establishment right with the consequences of what overturning Roe would look like and what the consequences of an actual country where abortion, which they love to talk about being a moral outrage when they have to, you know, they will lean into it when it's politically convenient for them, and act as though it is a moral outrage, but they don't really do much about it. And when things are actually done about it, I don't think they're prepared to reckon with it. And I actually don't think the conservative movement realizes, because a lot of the movement itself is actually genuinely pro-life. I don't think they maybe understand fully the extent to which the establishment right will be throwing people under the bus. Even the Texas law itself, we saw a lot of establishment people on the right talking about, like, well, was this really, you know, wise? And they weren't really talking about the evil of the practice. So that's something I think will come into play shortly as this case is litigated.
Just briefly on the sort of Roberts perspective of protecting the, I would characterize it as protecting the institutions, but not the Constitution. And essentially, even if there's bad law in the books, don't you dare upset the apple cart and challenge precedent. I just think it's an asinine position. It's an absurd position. The notion of protecting the court by overriding law is just simply indefensible in my view. So I think that position doesn't pass muster. But this goes back to kind of the failure theater sort of meme that has characterized all of the various cohorts of the Republican establishment in a whole slew of areas. And I think, Josh, it was what very well said in terms of noting that this is sort of a proxy for what we see across the board regarding Conservatism Inc. or Republicanism Inc. in all of its manifestations. And I think this gets to a breaking point of, we always heard about, you know, we can't do anything unless we take the presidency. And then, well, we need Congress, and then we need the Supreme Court, et cetera. But if you fail every single time, at a certain point, there is a total loss in confidence in the integrity of these institutions, which seemingly proclaim to stand for certain things, but then end up, when they actually have an opportunity to effectuate the changes that their animated constituents want, fail to do so. I think that chasm, and it's sort of, you know, the broader chasm of the ruling class versus the deplorables, or like the backbenchers versus the establishmentarians actually in power. I think maybe it is reaching a breaking point, and that is a good and healthy thing, because that's the only way there can be necessary change. And that, you know, what the animated cohort of, you know, what we'll talk about in the next segment, sort of national conservatives, actually get to express themselves and lead to real concrete changes that make a difference in this country. So it's, I think it's all to the good, frankly, and we ought to be hashing out and having these conversations.
Yeah, no, totally. And just to, like, really quickly wrap a bow on this, and then I'll toss it right back to you, Ben. The national conservatism movement, this is a perfect segue, actually, definitely was discussed, like in the halls of the Mayflower. A lot of people came up to me and said, like, loved your speech, loved the other people's speeches, whatever here. But there was nothing even, like, remotely similar kind of, like, to that as far as, like, the substantive programming itself, right? But anyway, let's not waste any more time. Let's throw it back to you, Ben. So what, in the aftermath of the Orlando NACON conference, there's a lot of talk about what divides us, but you want to talk about what unites us.
Yeah, and I think it's important on both a theoretical and practical level to talk about this. And frankly, it's something that I've tried to grapple with, and it really transcends the Trump, you know, again, deplorables versus kind of ruling class divide, although that is a part of it. I think, you know, what I found was that there were these articles in the wake of national conservatism from, you know, folks, roughly you would say, somewhat like-minded, right-leaning individuals talking about, you know, basically this is intellectually incoherent. Like, how can you have all these people under the same house together? And I tried to think through, you know, kind of what actually is it that does unite us, or could unite us, and frankly has to unite us, because we face existential threats here. And the way that I kind of characterized it in this piece in The Federalist is that there are really three things that unite us. First, we see these common existential threats facing us, and I characterize those as a cold civil war, to pay homage to the late Angelo Codevilla, at home, and then abroad, a China which is pursuing a hot war by other means, as I would term it, in a whole slew of domains beyond, of course, posing a military threat to the United States. Secondly, with respect to these threats, is the fact that these threats have only arisen because we have not at all prepared the kind of counter response necessary. You know, simply going along with not fighting culture war issues, for example, not fighting these existential battles that underlie questions or go well before questions of, as we've talked about before, you know, marginal tax rates or the size scope of the social welfare state, et cetera, et cetera. These things are really secondary when you're talking about, are we a good country or are we an evil country? And like, what kind of place do we want to raise our children in, et cetera? And I think that kind of gets to the third point, you know, on top of this idea of we're not going to solve these problems by responding with the very solutions that created these problems in the first place, encountering these forces that threaten to unglue this country, is the idea that we are united by certain core beliefs that underpin the ability to even have debates around those kind of issues, which are so far, you know, tangential, tertiary at this point, like the tax rates of the administrative state or all these other things that are very important. But unlike when we faced prior existential threats, like during the Cold War, for example, across the political aisle and certainly among our elite, there really is a divide about those questions like, are we a good country or an evil country? Like, what is the American way of life? Is the American way of life worth defending? Who would defend the American life to the extent you think that we are a deplorable bastion of bigotry and evil, and that our enemies actually have a point, that who are we to challenge the and you know, try to claim no moral equivalence between us and XYZ horrible power around the world? So in this piece of The Federalist, I sort of lay out some of the things that unite us, and I'll just repeat a few of them real quick. You know, and this is really basically, are you woke or are you anti-woke to some extent? And it's cultural and it's ideological as well. But I think it's also just fundamentally about what you think about the country and the society that this country is supposed to enable to flourish. So a few of the things that I lay out, you know, America is good. Judeo-Christian morality and virtue are the predicates for goodness, freedom, and justice. There are two sexes. Strong families are our essential building block. America requires borders. Immigrants must assimilate. Law and order and equal justice are imperative. Communities must be safe, orderly, and cohesive. Schools exist to teach children how to think and to be patriotic and productive citizens. Society must cultivate excellence, not mediocrity. The interests of the nation and its people must be put first, period, full stop. And culture trumps economics. And thinking about it, you know, the other thing that I would add is that we, of course, have to have free speech, period, full stop. And that threats to free speech, even under the guise of being private actors infringing upon that speech, I have to be put down. Those threats cannot be allowed to stand. And, you know, during the National Conservatism Conference, and I allude to this in the piece, you know, I thought Chris Rufo laid out tactically that the offensive against CRT and wokeism in our schools presents a model that can be replicated on a whole slew of similar issues. I alluded to Josh's speech as well in terms of the broader theoretical underpinnings of this argument. And then Rachel's as well, I want to commend for a great rousing speech with respect to how to fight on all of these grounds politically. But I just think that there is something that underlies and unites people who may have, you know, disparate takes on tactically how we go about taking on these issues. But at core, we agree on a few really important things. And that not only ought to be enough to unite us, but it has to be enough to unite us given the size, scope, and nature of the threats at home and abroad that we face. So others, you know, I'd be curious to know what you think about this, both on an ideological and then a practical level as well. If you had any other critiques of national conservatism, I'd welcome them.
I'll just jump in quickly to say, I think one thing, Ben, you just mentioned, the problems won't be solved by the things that created the problems in the first place. And I think that's an important point. And I also think Chris Rufo is a really good example. I think the conservative movement has been navel-gazing for decades and sort of reveling in these spats back and forth between this NR writer and this Weekly Standard writer and this, you guys know what I'm talking about. And I think that we have to turn outward, and it's not that people haven't been trying. It's extremely difficult, but I think Rufo showed that if you do work, if you do look outward and you do sort of adopt very practical methods of talking, and he's somebody, by the way, who came really in a CPAC every single year, listening to the same people talk about the same panels, talk on the same panels, and reading, you know, every single thing that, I don't know, any George Will put out, whatever. And so he came in with really fresh eyes. And I think there are a lot of people as Nat Kahn showed, somebody like Batya coming into the conservative movement with fresh eyes right now. Chris Rufo, Batya, Amanda Melius was on the panel that I was on with Batya as well. And I think coming in with those fresh eyes and turning outward, those are two really important things. And the sort of navel gazing that gets to be so like ego stoking between this bow tie wearing writer and this pipe smoking corncob pipe smoking writer, that's sort of an era that has to end in the conservative movement, and Rufo is a great example of how to do that.
I think that's so, well put, because
go ahead Rachel, sorry.
Yeah, because I do think that there's a lot of debate right now, which I think is artificial, which is like, well, this is a new conservatism and all this. And I sort of made this point, I think Ben, you implicitly just made the point in your piece too, I made this point in my speech, that this isn't new conservatism, this is conservatism reprioritizing, you know, what it focuses on. And that's, I think, what's essential to this debate that's sometimes missed. And, you know, the movement towards like national conservatism, I think, has grown out of, again, a foresight and a looking ahead to the challenges we now face, where I think what we chafe up against in DC is this sort of what we, you know, dismissively refer to as Kahn Inc. But it's just this, again, to use Emily's term, navel gazing way of thinking that, again, you know, the priorities of the 1980s, of Reaganism, of whatever you want to call it, business focused conservatism, somehow apply when you're dealing with truly existential threats. I think Emily's term navel gazing is important here, because I think there's a lot of debates being had right now that I think are a little bit of a distraction about NatCon or national conservatism, you know, being a new type of conservatism. And I try to make this point in my speech that I don't really think it is at all. I think it's simply, you know, conservatives reprioritizing their emphasis, you know, recognizing new threats, pulling on our traditions, you know, taking them out of the box and applying them to this present moment, rejecting, I think, what we chafe against, which is this sort of what we call Kahn Inc., right, in DC, which again is the navel gazing, this ability or this focus on, you know, political solutions that worked for an old political coalition of the 1980s and thinking they're going to be exactly the same here, treating what is temporal, right, as though it's eternal. And I think that is the mistake. But I don't think that we're upending conservatism by any means. And I think, you know, Rufo's example is so instructive for a number of reasons, but one of them is because he came from the outside, because he went to the existing institutions and said, I'm trying to fight this new threat. Can you help me? And they all said basically no, right? We don't do this. We're not equipped for this. And so he went and built that movement himself. And I think that is what you're seeing. You know, so much of the energy and light and heat around national conservatism is that reflection of, you know, acknowledging new threats and addressing them as they arise, using it within our existing traditions. And to me, that's, you know, why there's so much energy there.
So look, I agree with everything that's already been said here. I mean, I think back a little bit to this American Compass blog post that I wrote last March. I think it was entitled The Deliberalizing Imperative here. And like the basic argument, I'll just briefly read from this blog post, was I said, quote, simply put, the pendulum of the post-World War II fusionist conservative movement has swung far too much toward libertarianism. It's not entirely obvious exactly when this modern fusionist American conservative movement became so libertarian, individual liberty-centric, but it's undeniable that it happened. And then a little later, I said, we being broader kind of NatCon, New Right, and so forth world, we must all work in tandem, putting aside whatever differences we may have in service of a larger, more important goal, resisting the toxic combination of excessive economic and cultural deregulation that has blighted our post-World War II society and resulted in atomized, despondent citizenry, right? So that kind of is the crux of the argument here. You know, Sohrab Ahmari, my good friend, for whatever differences we may or may not have, I don't think any of the four of us would self-identify as an integralist or anything. I mean, his speech, I think, kind of nailed this. I mean, talking about how you ultimately, and if this sounds like quasi-Marxist, I guess so be it, you ultimately cannot disentangle the economic and the cultural. Economic policy has manifestly cultural ramifications, and like you can't just talk about it in the abstract, you know, pursuing kind of blind laissez-faire offshoring jobs at all costs sort of kind of neoliberal economic policy without expecting there to be kind of a cultural pushback at some point here, right? So I think it was Michael Knowles in his NatCon speech had some like funny applause line, right, where he talked about how like Straussian, Claremonster, Paleocon, Berkey, and it's like the rights version of gender pronouns, right? I don't remember the exact line, but it's something like that, right? And I totally agree with that. The imperative is to kind of put that aside and focus on what we agree upon, which is that we need more consolidation, more meaning, and that does and ought to, I think, require a slightly heavier wielding of state power when necessary to push back against the woke agenda.
Yeah, just to add to that, as and because the times demand it and the circumstances require it, because we have ceded every single other part of the entire power structure that exists in this country. Again, also not to sound Marxian, but the bottom line is these are the threats we face. These are the stakes, the circumstances. And so you have to be able to apply creative tactics and strategies given the threats we face. And I think Rachel is totally right to talk about it. It's more a reprioritization than completely dispensing with what we've done before, but there do need to be a different tactic certainly applied, because there's concentrated public and private power, oftentimes on the side of our worst foreign adversary, communist China, that's trying to grind us to heel, essentially. So of course we have to react this way.
So we can go ahead and transition to the Rittenhouse trial right now, where there are some, I think, battle lines, even on the right, being drawn. As we are recording this episode on Tuesday evening, jurors in Kenosha, which is not far from where I grew up, are deliberating over the evidence and will be rendering a verdict at some point soon. We don't know if it's tonight, and certainly that could happen by the time this episode airs. And so we can keep the conversation general enough to say that right now there are, I think, 500 National Guard troops at the ready in Kenosha, because they are anticipating possible riots. Given that this trial of Kyle Rittenhouse was set up to be the trial of a white supremacist out for blood. And what I wanted to talk about in this segment is the many revelations from the left over the past week, and as this trial has played out publicly, of people saying, I had no idea that Kyle Rittenhouse's victims were not Black. I've seen that that sentiment expressed over and over again. And I think it's a good example of how our media sets the country up for division and sets the country up for these sort of painful trials, where Rittenhouse is now being sort of thrust into this position of like some sort of avatar for something. I mean, I don't even know what. A kid who, in my opinion, made a bad decision to, as a literally 17-year-old, go armed into essentially what was a war zone. Same time, he wanted to help protect the community that he worked in. And so, I mean, I think it's a bad decision, but to hold it up as a clear-cut case of white supremacy, as I believe, I think it was Ayanna Pressley, one of the squad members, did, it's outrageous. And it sort of creates this false reality that we live in a country where the streets are literally patrolled by AR-wielding white supremacists who are out for blood, like something out of the Jim Crow era. We have the president of the United States calling voting laws like Jim Crow 2.0. And it just does such an enormous disservice to the country. It's political rhetoric for the sake of scoring points and getting votes. But it has, I think, really created a false reality for a lot of people in the country. And as the trial played out over the course of the last couple of weeks, I think that was really clear. So with that, I'll open it up to the group.
It has been incredible to watch people either stay in or realize the echo chamber they've been living in. You don't often get examples of this, but you know, you actually have seen people on the left come out and say, I did not even understand the facts of this case as presented to me by the media. Because again, as Emily pointed out, they completely distorted the narrative to make it about white supremacy, ignoring the fact or dismissing entirely the fact that it was a white guy shooting three other white guys. And there was no racial element to this case at all. And it was completely racialized. And it's amazing because, you know, we talk so much, you know, in the big tech debates and all this stuff about misinformation. This is our established media, right? This isn't, you know, I'd love to say this is some fringe actor. No, this is our established media, you know, presenting this narrative that, you know, if there is a verdict that results in Kyle Rittenhouse being acquitted, you know, of these charges, acquitted on self-defense, I think that there will be some protesting and rioting. And I place that squarely at the feet of these media actors that pushed a narrative they knew to be false, or they were careless enough to, like PolitiFact, claim, you know, that it was totally illegal for Kyle Rittenhouse to possess that gun because he was underage, which a little bit of research could have shown was not at all illegal, so much that it was not at all illegal that count was tossed out in court. And this is, we are living in two separate worlds where there is facts on one side and an artificially constructed reality on the other. And I don't think this is, I have to think this is a little bit unprecedented in this media age to see something so distorted.
Well, let me just say it's ironic that it's happening now, given that the Steele dossier has also collapsed and the media is still, to some extent, continues to cling to it, even though, you know, the Washington Post has come out and they've basically retracted substantial portions of reports that they've done in the past. There's still a hesitancy among in some quarters to even cover the fact that Durham's indictments have completely indicted the media and its culpability in spinning this 5-year-long effort to smear the former president as basically a traitor to the country who's aligned with our greatest adversary, Russia, which of course distracted us from China the entire time over those 5 years. Even Andrew Sullivan had a post, I think, recently talking about basically every single narrative the media has put out on all of the biggest news stories, its controversies over the last few years, has proven to be a false narrative. There's a question of, is it incompetence or malice? I think it's a combination of the two, although you can see that established media do a very dogged job of presenting the cases against people they don't like, and they get all their sources lined up. Sometimes made up, granted, but they get their sources aligned and they work their angles and they build these very comprehensive pieces that appear very compelling on the surface. But the reality is you can see that there is a bias and even beyond a bias, an animus towards those who do not comport with their worldview, essentially. And that results in god-awful reporting. And so I do hold the media culpable for getting people agitated and wound up in a case like this. But I also would take a step back. And I felt this too when it came to the reports right before the 2020 presidential election of, you know, boarding up large swaths of DC, for example, prior to election night, or around the Chauvin trial, that there were all of these precautions being taken. To me, first of all, it means that when it comes to one of these cases, the jurors themselves, and there was doxing, it appears, in this case of one or several jurors or an attempt to do so. There's no justice in this country when there's intimidation against jurors to weigh the facts in as objective a fashion as they can. When you're basically rendering justice at the point of a gun, of a mob gun, essentially. And to me, that's something that even worse than where the media is, and they are culpable definitely in provoking these sorts of unhinged reactions from people. The notion that XYZ city is going to blow up if a court decision doesn't come down the right way, in the opinion of people, I know it's not unprecedented in American history, and it happens in civil societies, and it has happened in civil societies for decades, but it points to a much deeper rot, sickness in our society, that in these sorts of cases, it's literally that order is going to explode. And oh, by the way, let's not forget that the whole reason this case transpired is because there was no law and order in the first place, which is why Rittenhouse was out in the street and ended up in this situation to begin with. So this gets to a deeper societal rot in terms of, first of all, the lack of civil behavior in our increasingly uncivil society. And then, of course, the fact that the authorities themselves stoke it by not providing law and order. And in some cases, of course, like our vice president, calling to bail out those engaging in the very type of activity that Rittenhouse himself, it appears, was out trying to defend against. And then you add to it our media, which of course is on that same side. And it's just it's a failure across the board from our institutions right down to our people who've been misled by those institutions, but who themselves also are culpable in acting this way in a way that simply is un-American, quite frankly.
It is un-American. That's exactly the right term to use, actually. I mean, this entire mob mentality of this implicit threat to riot in the streets. I've noticed Ariel Davidson tweeting a lot about this. She's totally right when she does so. I mean, this notion that we will burn the streets down if we don't get our way on like a random one-off trial, whether it's Chauvin, whether it's Rittenhouse, whether it's anyone else. That's banana republic type stuff. Like, that's literally what you expect from like a third world sub-Saharan African country, right? I mean, that is simply not how we do things, or at least it's at least not how we used to and how we ought to do things in the United States. I mean, you know, we've said this on the show in the past, but it reminds me, of course, of the famous Lincoln line from his 1838 Lyceum address. He said, quote, "There is no grievance that is a fit object of redress by mob law." I mean, like, that is like an American ethos, that we have a criminal justice system, And, you know, you can obviously appeal it and you can take all full use of the various procedural mechanisms, obviously, in that criminal justice system. But you're not going to burn the entire damn thing down if it doesn't go your way. So I completely agree with Ben's use of the phrase un-American. That is quite literally what this implicit threat to burn everything down is. On the Rittenhouse trial itself, I candidly have not followed it super closely. It seems to not exactly be going well for the prosecution, to put it mildly here. I don't want to go full, like, aggressive red pill and say that Kyle Rittenhouse is a hero, even though I think he probably is a hero. But I want to make a slightly different point, which is that what he did here in terms of in a situation of anarchic breakdown, in trying to go there with his weapon to try to defend property owners, try to defend individuals who did not benefit at the time from law enforcement, just the total breakdown of any sort of government ability to protect an innocent citizenry, that literally is why the Second Amendment exists, okay? The Second Amendment does not exist, obviously, as everyone in this podcast knows, to go hunting. The Second Amendment does not exist even to defend necessarily your home from a burglar. It's quite good for that, but like that's not literally why it exists. It literally does exist for when there is anarchic breakdown in society, whether it's come the Rodney King riots in LA, whether it's post Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where everything was flooded and the police were nowhere. That is the kind of situation where it exists here. So should Kyle Rittenhouse have gone to Kenosha that day? I don't know. I mean, like, frankly, if anything, it strikes me as kind of a morally righteous and selfless thing to do. I don't really know the kid or what his specific motives were, but I think there was a strong case to be had that Kyle Rittenhouse is a hero for what he did. But even holding that aside, this is the quintessential use and is the quintessential defense of the Second Amendment. And I think in kind of a bygone era, we would have inherently understood this. We would have seen this for what it is, which is kind of an act of strong kind of Tocquevillian kind of Republican self-governance, love of country, and kind of a virtue and manliness, for lack of a better term, kind of being put into practice. So hoping and praying for the best for Mr. Rittenhouse. I suspect when this podcast comes out, we may have had an answer, actually.
Yeah, so transitioning to another politicization of justice in America. people may have seen, you know, earlier this week, well, I guess it was at the end of last week, Steve Bannon, who was subpoenaed by the January 6th Commission in Congress, you know, refused to show up for his subpoena, was held in contempt of Congress, and the criminal referral was sent to DOJ. Many, many of these criminal referrals are sent to DOJ. Hundreds of them are not acted upon ever. Well, DOJ acted upon this one the first time, I believe, since 1983, and has now, you know, is prepared to try Steve Bannon for contempt of Congress. He faces, I think, up to a year in jail, up to a $100,000 fine. Now, I want to frame this for people who haven't been following the January 6th Commission. I just want to start with this. The FBI has investigated, as corrupt as the FBI is, the FBI has investigated the January 6th activities and found there was no sort of network or collusion or giant conspiracy to breach the Capitol, that it was sort of in the moment by, you know, independent actors acting sort of in the heat of it. They have found, again, no general conspiracy to do this. They have interviewed individuals. They've charged, you know, how many, you know, individuals that are now in jail. Yet the January 6th Commission has taken upon itself to further investigate this, and in doing so, harvesting the private records of innocent Americans, Americans who in many cases have either never been investigated by the FBI because there was no grounds, or been investigated and cleared. They are harvesting their private details. They are looking for cell and text records of members of Congress. So this committee is already sort of going, setting unprecedented bounds for itself in terms of, you know, the breaches of privacy and protocol. And on top of that, they are now, they have, you know, pushed DOJ, I think probably with the willingness of Merrick Garland, to, again, for the first time in over 30 years, pursue a criminal contempt charge against an individual citizen. And this is, I think, just a tremendous breach. You know, when you think about how many people have been held in contempt by Congress, even just by Republicans, I go back to Lois Lerner, right, who was the IRS official that weaponized the IRS against conservatives. I go back to Eric Holder, the former attorney general under the Obama administration, who was held in contempt for refusing to show up to discuss the Fast and Furious scandal. I even go back to the multiple criminal referrals that Chuck Grassley made of Michael Avenatti during the Kavanaugh confirmation, you know, bringing them to a Republican Department of Justice saying, look, this man brought forth lies, you know, saying that Kavanaugh was involved or somehow present at a gang rape, which was revealed to be complete fabrication, you know, wasting time smearing the character of a nominee. Yet at all of those times, the Department of Justice said, we're not going to get involved because we don't want to overly politicize what is an act of the law, an act of justice over what we think is politics. But not so for the Biden administration. They have really walked through a door here that I think is really unprecedented. And I'm not sure it stands up to judicial scrutiny based on, you know, Trump v. Mazars, which basically says any congressional subpoena has to have an explicit legislative purpose. That is, it has to be in pursuit of lawmaking. This is not in pursuit of lawmaking at all. In sort of looking back on the history of what Congress has done and what they can do, there were a number of contempt citations that did not stand during the House Un-American Activities Committee. And one in particular made it to the Supreme Court, that of John Thomas Watkins. And I wanted to quote from what Justice Earl Warren wrote when overturning his conviction for contempt. He said, quote, there is no congressional power to expose for the sake of exposure. And that is exactly what this committee is intent on doing. The FBI has already said there's no grand conspiracy. The GOA has already looked into this claim that Republican members of Congress were like conducting reconnaissance by giving their constituents tours and found it baseless. There is nothing here but overt political gamesmanship. And now they are intent on dragging former political officials into it. And, you know, look, they are setting up the precedent for Republicans to do this should they take back the House. But of course, you know, Republicans would have to have a lot of stones, I think, to be able to follow through. And I'm not sure that they will. But I put this forward because I don't necessarily think on the right it's getting the attention it deserves for how blatant and how gross the sort of just politicization of the Justice Department yet again in this instance.
Well, let me just state first on the narrow part about Republicans having no stones to do an equivalent thing. That's exactly why the Democrats do this, because they know that they will not be met with an equal and opposite counter reaction. And I think that you frame this very well in making very clear what I would summarize as the fact that what Democrats in Congress are trying to do is execute the political persecution that they can't get from the legal prosecution. The DOJ, which for all its talk about shock and awe, sedition, et cetera, in the words of leading DOJ officials, none of the cases that they're prosecuting come remotely close to that. In fact, really, the gravest charge that's being put forth is a novel one, which is obstructing an official proceeding. I'm paraphrasing that, which hasn't really been applied in an equivalent circumstance, by the way. And that's like the crux of their greatest cases. And oh, by the way, as we've talked about, or at least alluded to in the past, you know, those who were members of organized groups, it appears there were at least several informants associated with them. And some of the leading organizers themselves haven't been pursued, at least to date, by the DOJ. So, yeah, it's a joke, but it's more than a joke because it does get to this precedent that's being set of using the full power of the federal government to target the political opposition, essentially. That's really what this is about. The civil liberty infringements are obviously there. There's who would ever want to work in a Republican administration again, potentially, if you knew that you would be subjected to, in essence, this sort of retaliation going forward. Obviously, part of this is probably trying to drag these people through the mud to try and smear and target and chill anyone around President Trump, former President Trump, going into 2024. So there's that aspect of it as well. One of the funniest things, of course, about all of this, though, is Merrick Garland's statement when this indictment came out. And I'll just read briefly from it. Since my first day in office, I've promised Justice Department employees that together we would show the American people by word and deed that the department adheres to the rule of law, follows the facts and the law, and pursues equal justice under the law. Today's charges reflect the department's steadfast commitment to these principles. I mean, this is Soviet stuff. That is seriously, like, when you compare what the Justice Department is doing. And right before we came to record this today, by the way, a whistleblower apparently presented documents showing that the DOJ was out there pursuing parents using counterterrorism authorities or powers here. And this is really some of the most chilling kind of behavior that we've ever seen. And maybe this is the way that our national security and intelligence apparatuses have acted in the past, and we just didn't know it. But my God, we've crossed the Rubicon. You know, during his hearing, Attorney General Merrick Garland's hearing, in front of the House Judiciary Committee, where he was challenged on the targeting of parents, there was a Ukrainian-born representative representing a district in Indiana who said that the FBI is acting like the KGB or the FSB, and it didn't get a lot of play. But on a daily basis, it really seems to be proving itself out. It's shocking, it's chilling, and this is further evidence of the banana republicanization of America.
I think that's really well said. I mean, honestly, I was going to save what I was about to say here for closing thoughts, but it honestly kind of fits really well in here as well. I mean, just talking on the broader point of the politicization of the DOJ and by extension, the intelligence community as well. We haven't even talked about what's going on at Project Veritas with James O'Keefe and what's happening there. Just to kind of catch all the viewers up here, the FBI basically pre-dawn raided James O'Keefe's house. I believe he's in Westchester County, New York, if I'm not mistaken there. He was kind of in handcuffs in his own house for a handful of hours. There is no particular charge that I'm aware of that is currently being investigated. There's no particular allegation of misdoing here. And in the midst of this right now, O'Keefe is not currently sitting behind bars as we speak, but in the midst of all of this here, and the story here, by the way, gets back to what's the Biden relative's name? I'm blanking on the first name.
Ashley Biden.
Thank you. Yeah. It gets back to kind of documents that Project Veritas got from Ashley Biden. I have not seen a serious allegation that these documents were obtained illegally or anything of that nature here, but the what makes this even worse is that then there was a New York Times article that I saw that our friend and sometimes co-host Will Chamberlain was tweeting about just last week. There was a New York Times article where it was obvious that the FBI, after going into O'Keefe's house and reading this about the Ashley Biden stuff, then was feeding information to the New York Times there, and was basically, I don't remember the exact quote, but they were basically saying the New York Times here, like the FBI is interrogating whether or not Project Veritas is following all proper procedures there. But the point here is that the FBI and the New York Times literally just ganged up. They ganged up on this third party operation here with no particular semblance of independent rule of law integrity whatsoever. It's Marxist Stalinist tactics here. I mean, these are like literally like the tactics of it is a ruling class that is like a monolithic, sprawling, intellectually cloistered ruling class that extends its tentacles across all various institutions, whether it's the media, the deep state, whatever. And they're here to subjugate us. They are here ultimately to subjugate people who think like us here. And maybe we can flesh that out in closing thoughts, because it's just pretty just Orwellian stuff, honestly.
That's actually exactly where I was going to go. I was going to say, I heard that the ACLU had defended Project Veritas and James O'Keefe against the FBI raid. And my thought is, well, that's what we need is institutions that can, and the ACLU, the arc of the ACLU has been so sad and disappointing and just so representative of the arc of our sort of broader cultural understanding of what justice is and what free expression is. And I think that's why they're sort of like an important thing to watch. And so them sort of having the right take on this is important. But more importantly than that, all of our institutions need to hold in the face of this. If the government is abusing its power, as we've seen even before this era in our politics, but maybe not on this level, then our institutions need to hold and our culture needs to hold. And so I thought the ACLU was actually a rare positive sign in the last week.
Yeah, I think we can pick up on final thoughts, and because I think this is an interesting thread to pull on, because, you know, the institutions themselves, at least the institutions of government, are not holding. And I think that's, you know, what's sending shivers down the spines of all of us. And I think it's the thread that links a lot of these discussion items, you know, from Rittenhouse, you know, to Bannon, to even, you know, kind of James O'Keefe. It's this mob justice. It's this idea that even if, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted, that he will be hunted, you know, by leading institutions, that he will, you know, probably struggle to seek employment, that his life is going to be forever changed because of this mob justice that we have. You know, you see the James O'Keefe, I think, example is illuminating here too, because according to his side of the story, he turned over the diary, the Ashley Biden diary, to the FBI because he was concerned it was stolen. And that was like journalistic ethics for handling stolen material or whatever. That's his side of the story. If that's the case, what the hell is the FBI doing?
Exactly.
And also, if that's the case, what the hell is the FBI doing acting as sort of a personal law enforcement for Joe Biden, for members of his family? So I do think that, you know, conservatives, I think, have always looked with skepticism at sort of what we have termed the deep state, right? Because we, you know, think that it's out of control and whatever, you know, bureaucrats run amok. But what we're seeing here is even more disturbing. It's law enforcement taken to the level of, you know, enforcing political agendas on people. And I do wonder how we pull this back. That is of concern to me. I don't know that I have a very clear answer yet, but a self-government cannot survive when it weaponizes its institutions like this.
Also note that he turned over, reportedly, he turned over that diary and felt that it would have been journalistically unethical to print it. But again, the Steele dossier, 100% unverified, was printed by everyone and spread to the government from 50 different angles. So it's just remarkable.
And no one has retracted that. No one's retracted it. The Washington Post like deleted parts of their stories, but that's it. There were no retractions. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Look, go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say my final thought is basically just what I said, because all of these problems are enabled by a culture that no longer shares certain basic definitions, as we talk about all of the time. And that's really the bulwark. The bulwark against our system of government being used to the ends of tyranny or authoritarianism or whatever the secular cultural leftism is, the bulwark is the people. And the government does a lot of stuff top down. Our corporate overlords do a lot of stuff top down. They're trying to change our culture. They're trying to numb us and to neutralize us. But it's a race against the clock, right? Like if people can sort of be shocked back into reality, and the Virginia election, I think, was a good sign of that. And Rufo's success, I think, has been a good sign of that. Then the stuff, even Democrats can't get away with this stuff in a healthier culture. And
Emily giving us the white pill.
Yeah. You're welcome. That's a thing to just keep in mind, I think.
It's an important thing to keep in mind. It's a very important thing to keep in mind. I like that take a lot. I mean, I guess my quick kind of closing thought, which is analogous to and kind of will hopefully weave together a little bit all of that we've been talking about here. I finally watched Ron DeSantis's keynote address at the Claremont Institute annual gala in Southern California that I think took place a few weeks ago. I think it might have been the weekend right before NatCon, actually. And it was a terrific address. He kind of went over like a lot of his accomplishments. But if you read between the lines, he is clearly charting a path forward for conservatism and for the American right. And kind of one of the marquee lines that stood out to me was, I think he expected a bigger applause line than he got. Like, I have no doubt like the Michael Knowles of the world applauded this, but I'm not sure about some of like all of like the LA donors. But the one line that he said was, he said, quote, corporate tax cuts in the year 2021 are not going to cut it. Right. And like, how can you listen to like all that we've talked about over the past 10 minutes, talking about Steve Bannon, talking about James O'Keefe, talking about just the complete weaponization of the halls of power, the corridors of power, the ostensibly quote unquote neutral institutions of justice in this country in collusion with the New York Times and the media, Jen Psaki teaming up with Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook? I mean, like, how do you look at what is actually happening in the world and kind of go back and say like, oh, you know, let's just cut marginal tax rates. Let's just deregulate XYZ industry. I mean, like, you have to live in another planet, right, to think that here. And that is, I mean, like, the sobering to that reality, if nothing else, right, is I think what like the broader like NatCon movement and national conservatism is about. We are trying to kind of, I think, disseminate this message that the time for the 1980s playbook is simply over. And like, you don't have to think of this as kind of burning it all down here. I think a lot of people look at this as kind of as like a Leninist kind of Robespierre take on conservatism. It's not. As Rachel said earlier, it's literally just like a reshuffling of priorities. It's kind of what I said when I was quoting my blog post. We have just erred way too much on the side of cultural and economic deregulation of neoliberalism at the expense of other things that have always been understood as conservative, like order and consolidation and national cohesion and things of that nature, right? So pointing that out, I think, is the imperative of all four of us and collectively on this podcast. And, you know, there's always some white pills to be spruced in there somewhere. So thank you, Emily, for that.
Well, let me just say really briefly on that, the whole kind of fusionism, not the 1980s called, but the whole 1980s, you know, tisk-tisking about it. But Reagan was dealing with the challenges of his time. And I have to imagine that if Reagan were recast today, he would reshuffle his priorities too. And he might not have even fathomed how far down we've gone in not just a, you know, road to economic serfdom, but a road to serfdom in like every realm of American life. So I just think that it's the height of folly to attack when he gets invoked and attacked, and not by us, but by some. I think it's a misreading of Reagan, and it's worth going back and reading his speeches and writings over the years, because, you know, he would be standing right on these battle lines with us. So I think he's worth defending in this. But two other kind of silver linings that I'll point out. The nature and extent and just the sheer volume of the corruption and the tyrannical acts that we've seen has been exposed to, I think, an unprecedented degree, maybe because of the sheer mass of it. And I do think that's a good thing, because you can't look away from it, no matter the censorship and the deplatforming and such. It's there for anyone with eyes who wants to see it, even if the algorithms try to turn people against it. So I think that is a good thing, because the only way that people do get woke to this woke anti-cultural revolution is to see it with their own eyes. And related to that, I think it's very clear, and you know, these election results in part for 2021 reflect this, the left's failures ultimately cannot be hidden. When you have massive inflation, when you have societal breakdown, which is probably even more important than all the economic losses that are going to transpire, when you have the sheer insanity of the draconian coronavirus policies and the consequences for kids, when people actually see what their kids are being indoctrinated into in their schools thanks to remote learning. So all of those things, while terrible, are a positive in that, again, people see it with their own eyes. They see the failure of the woke ruling class in every institution that it commands, and how everything their regressive progressivism touches turns to rubble. The challenge for us is to then catalyze the unwoke, unwashed masses to fight back against them. And I think that's in part what national conservatism is about.
Well, on that note, on behalf of Ben, Emily, and Josh, we'll see you on the next NatCon Squad.